everyone, and welcome to the next edition of the VTX podcast. Here at the Veterinary Thought Exchange, we like to start by asking, what are you thinking? And this week, we're going to be thinking and chatting with the amazing Sarah. Sarah is a small animal vet. She is an advanced practitioner in small animal medicine. She loves the ultrasound machine, and she has a particular passion for cardiology. But in many ways, we don't talk about any of that today. We talk about putting your own mask on first, and actually, in Sarah's case, how she came to make the masks during COVID and some of the more challenging points in all of our careers. We talk about the pain of realizing that maybe this career is not exactly what you thought it was going to be. It maybe isn't the picture-perfect James Herriot idea that you had in your head. But Sarah talks about how she has made this career work for her. And I hope that some of what we talk about today is relevant to some of the challenges that we're facing in the profession right now. In our clinical segment today, we chat to the wonderful Sophie from Zoetis. And actually today we're talking about the use of AI in veterinary medicine, which on face value, I was like, I'm not sure about this. But actually, what an interesting topic and what an interesting conversation with Sophie. We want to say a massive thank you to Zoetis for supporting this podcast and our series of podcasts with a dermatology theme. Okay, well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. I have sort of spent a bit of time thinking about our conversation. And as always, I think the best thing to do is not to think about it too much and just to see where we go. So I wonder whether we can start just by you introducing yourself to the listeners and just maybe giving us a little bit of an idea about your veterinary career.
Yeah, certainly. So thank you, Scott, for inviting me to speak to you today. So I graduated in 2002, and I just realized this past week how long ago that was. when I graduated, I just wanted to be James Herriot. And that's what I did for 5 years. I did mixed mainly large animal practice up in Cumbria. And I loved being a farm vet. But I was doing the same job at 5 years as I was the day I arrived as a new graduate, just maybe a bit more confident in what I was doing. So I moved on from there. By that stage, I'd met my fiance and we traveled around the world. When we came back to the UK, his job was a bit more specific, non-veterinary. So we ended up down in the southeast where there really isn't many cows. So I made the change to small animal, which I think was probably on what I was going to be doing anyway. I spent nearly 10 years in the practice there. I did a medicine certificate, became an advanced practitioner in medicine, doing lots of ultrasonography at that time. And then that practice changed over time and it was time for me to move on. And I had a few jobs that I was not particularly happy in. They weren't good fits. They weren't exactly what I'd been led to believe when I took the jobs. And then I kind of fell into locuming as a stopgap to fill in time and earn some money while I found what I hoped would be the right job for me. And then COVID came along and all my work was cancelled.
Gosh, right. Now, that's funny, isn't it? Like, I think we've all got our different struggles with COVID, but as a locum, did things just stop?
Yep. I was literally thrown out the practice because the lockdown happened and you're self-employed. You don't have any comeback for that. So, yeah, I struggled to find work for about 6 months. I had a little sideline making face masks, which helped pay the bills a little bit.
Right. Oh, my God. That's crazy, isn't it? You kind of forget that happened. Like, yeah. Suddenly, you know, one day I'm a relatively, I'm sure, well-remunerated locum vet. And then the next day I'm like, oh, I better make some face masks. That's crazy, isn't it? And does that not feel like another world now? Does that not feel like,
It does. Yeah. No, I have to say, at the time, it didn't particularly throw me. It was a bit of a, okay, right. We need to make the best of this circumstance. What can I do that can do it? Staying at home, using the skills that I've got. And I do lots of crafting. So I just kind of fell into making face masks. I did some for friends. I put pictures on social media, and then people said, oh, can we buy one? And then some practices said, can we buy them for our teams?
Oh,
so
wow.
I fell into doing that for a few months until the cheap ones came from China, and then people wouldn't pay for handmade ones in the UK.
Well, let's not get into the politics of PPE. I think that's already, plaguing politics a little bit. But so that's interesting, because one of the things that I think we wanted to maybe touch on was, I love this phrase, sort of squiggly careers. And I suppose, and you've made, I think you've had a, as we all probably have, a bit of a squiggly career. I think that's interesting, isn't it? I'm sure you didn't think that your career would squiggle to the point where you were making homemade face masks at home during a global pandemic, right? So I'm sure that wasn't the squiggle you predicted.
I didn't anticipate that. Yeah. When I was at vet school and graduated, I envisioned myself as James Herriot, within a few years becoming a partner in a veterinary practice and being settled for a long period of time. But reality doesn't happen like that. And also we have to realise that the wider culture in the UK and the whole world has really changed a lot over the past 20 years, not just in the profession, it's wider culture. And therefore that kind of scenario is really going to be quite rare going forward.
And do you think when you realise that maybe that scenario, that classic James Herriot scenario, that buying into practice, becoming a partner, how did you feel when you realized that maybe wasn't the way it was going to be? Were you disappointed, or did you kind of, was there a sadness in that wasn't the reality of the situation?
It was tainted with some sadness and a little bit of disappointment, but it wasn't soul-crushing disappointment and sadness, I have to say. I think I'm probably quite an optimistic person, so I just thought, well, something else will come along. And I have to say, up until after COVID, I hadn't really consciously built my career. I just did what felt right, what came along, opportunities came along. But after COVID, I thought, I can't keep doing this locum thing and these jobs that keep disappointing me. And so I ended up building my own perfect job. I didn't wait for it to come along. I've built it myself.
And I love that, it's interesting that consciously building my career. I wonder, is that something, do you think people need to be consciously doing that? Is that something that you think in order to achieve, happiness or fulfillment in the veterinary profession, do you think people need to be more conscious about how they are developing their careers?
Yes and no. That's a double-edged sword, that really. I've really enjoyed just seeing what opportunities came along and saying yes and no at times that felt right for me. But I also realised that if you understand yourself, you've built your self-awareness, you understand what you need, what you want out of your life, and part of your life is your career, then you do have to be intentional about your choices. And those are from the smallest everyday little choice over how you interact with the world, how you behave to the thoughts in your brain, all the way through to the intentional choices of choosing a job or where you're going to live in the country or the world.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that, going back to that idea that there was kind of that realization about, the reality of the veterinary profession maybe not being exactly what you thought it would be. I think one of the problems is, and I don't want to put words into anyone's mouth, but I think one of the problems is that people do get to that point in some way, lots of people, and you see this online and in real life, where they get to the point where there is a realization that it's just not what they thought ultimately, and that's I'm oversimplifying a very complicated subject. But ultimately, it's not what you thought. And at that stage, I think a lot of people are very disheartened and they want to leave the profession. And we definitely struggle with that. What's the solution there? Obviously, you're only one person. You can't just be dotting about the country being there at that moment that people realize that it's not quite what they thought. And you're like, wait, but it can be better. So if that's not a reality, which sadly in this day and age it's not, what's the solution to that moment where we're losing people because of that disengagement or whatever?
this is such a big topic in the profession at the moment, isn't it? It's really what we're all discussing on non-clinical terms. And it is a challenge because that is a pain point, isn't it? Where you probably most of us since teenager or even younger, we had our hopes on being a vet. We had in our mind what it was, but the problem was that ideal of what it was never quite real. It was always a kind of a myth. And then when we got out into the big wide world after vet school and that myth was destroyed, it is really quite painful. And then those cultures within the practices and the businesses that the profession works within, where it's not very supportive at that time. Now, there is no one solution to this. This is definitely going to be multifaceted. Everybody in the profession needs to help work on this, all the way from the top CEOs of the businesses that run in the profession, all the way through to the individuals. So my voice is just one tiny little voice within that sea of people. But how I go about this is I talk to people and investigate these kind of things. I think about them. I try to think about them from other points of view. And then I write about them. So part of what I do is I have a blog and I write about these non-clinical topics within the veterinary profession. And it's just things that come to me when I'm driving around or walking the dog or something. And I think, why don't we do it differently? What would happen if, for example, we tried reverse recruitment? And that was one of the things that I tried early in my diversification from general practice was, rather than me going and looking at the pages of the Vet Times and the Vet Record, could I get people to come to me with job offers? And the answer is yes. Yes, you most definitely can. Different ways of doing that.
Yeah. And that, so a couple of things I think interesting where, you know, you talk about, you know, change being, really involving everyone. And I think that's, you know, I very much agree with that. I wonder, I don't want to get again too controversial and political, but do you ever think that maybe some of the problem is the fact that in the very corporatized world that we live in now in the veterinary profession, that sometimes the problem is that many of these people who are running organizations or businesses don't actually really fully understand what the challenges at the coalface are? You know, so initially, and this is my opinion, that, you know, we brought in a lot of non-veterinary people into our world, you know, because they were good at running businesses. And they may well be good at running businesses, Debenhams or Specsavers or whatever. Does that
not,
mean...
Not Debenhams. They went...
Oh, no. I did work with someone who used to work at Debenhams. But but what I mean is, do you think that those sorts of people can be... You know, fully sort of understanding what these challenges are because they aren't from the veterinary sector?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is, I don't think we should shy away from talking about political topics. I think that's one of the failures in the profession is that we go, oh, that's a bit sticky, that topic. Let's not go there. We really do need to be openly discussing these topics and coming up with group solutions. We shouldn't shy away just from these difficult conversations. It's a very complex, nuanced thing. Has corporatization made a difference to the veterinary culture? And yes, it has. Not all of it is bad, but definitely there is now coming in that business mindset. And yeah, these people may well be good at running businesses, but they don't know the nuances of the veterinary profession because we're in a very kind of difficult position in which we work clinically. There are so many pulls for our emotions and our time, our energy, and a lot of them fight against each other. I call them the painful paradoxes of working in the veterinary profession, is that as a clinical vet, you have to satisfy the owner, but your regard is for the patient, the animal in front of you. And then over your shoulder, you've got your boss. Over the other shoulder, you've got the RCVS. And then in the background of all of that, you've got social media and things. So a lot of this is very unique to the veterinary profession. I think the medical profession does get it to a certain degree, but certainly for those that work in the NHS, there's kind of a wall there because they can say NHS doesn't let us do that. But being in private practice with a pet owner and a pet, it makes it very hard to navigate. And I think that's one area where we really haven't been given many skills to navigate this.
Mm-hmm. And I think the minute you bring animals and people in together in the same room and then throw in some money, then it just becomes very, very complicated very quickly, right? Like, I think that's just a recipe for complexity and emotion. And I think that we, you know, I love that, painful paradoxes. You should trademark that. I feel that, should we get t-shirts? I feel like that's really interesting. That's exactly what it is, though, isn't it? When that kind of perfect storm of different elements that just make our job uniquely challenging. And I think that's the thing, until you are really dealing with that every day as vets and nurses and receptionists and ACCAs, whatever, you can't really fully understand the challenge of that. You know, that's like, I think one of the things, actually, I thought, let's get political. Jeremy Vine was having a chat about the junior doctor strike, and a person who shall remain nameless, Edwina Curry, was on speaking very, very venomously about the fact that these junior doctors shouldn't be on strike. They should just put their big boy pants on and get back out to work. Now, regardless of what you think about all of that, what she was not really taking into consideration was the fact that she can never understand what those junior doctors are going through, you know, when they're actually doing their clinical work. Very easy for someone to say, just put on your big boy pants or big girl pants or big person pants and just get on with it. That's really, really naive and ridiculous. Do you know what I mean?
Like, she's so shown that in the past, though. This is the Edwina Curry of the chicken eggs.
Yes.
Don't eat chicken eggs because they've all got salmonella.
Right. Okay. So that's, thank you for putting that in context. So I could have stopped the car and ripped the radio out of the dashboard. Like, I was so, I never write into these things. I really felt like writing to Jeremy Vine. I might still do that. It's kind of gone now. Anyway. One of the things you mentioned there, which I think is really lovely, actually, and maybe kind of therapeutic for you, is to write a lot of this stuff down. So you write, which helps other people, you know, writing about these topics. I'm sure writing is therapeutic for you in some way. What do you, you know, when you put stuff out on a blog or when you put stuff out on social media, whatever, you know, stuff that you've written about quite challenging topics sometimes, do you feel, is that something that just goes out into the world and then it just disappears and you're like, oh, I'm glad I did that? What kind of impact does that have coming back to you? Do you feel repercussions from that? Do you feel what comes back from that sort of stuff?
Yeah, the first repercussion is, as you mentioned, it's therapeutic for myself. I only write about topics which inspire me or have tickled me in some way, and I feel impelled to write about them. So you're quite right, it's probably number one therapy for me. It's a bit like journaling, really. The second thing is that when I first started writing my blog, I wasn't really expecting an audience. I had a baking blog for many years, and I had like 6 people follow me. So I wasn't expecting anybody to follow me on my writing blog. But no, I think as time goes on, people have seen that what I write, and I hopefully respecting what I write, and I get some published now, which hopefully some through you as well, Scott.
Yes, yeah, we talked about it. But it's true. I think I actually think there's real bravery in, you know, writing, and first of all, I think I'm a bit jealous. I'm not very good at writing stuff like that, and I'm, you know, there's, I just think it's nice to be able to do that and I do think it's very helpful for people. And you know, there's a particular vet nurse, Lacey, who also does a lot of kind of writing, who I just, you know, when someone writes something, you're just like, God, that's...
She's so eloquent.
Yes.
She just nails it. She nails it every time. I'm so jealous.
But you know, you just were like, how do they make it sound like that? You know, when I sit for about 3 days with a LinkedIn post going, Oh, I can't even. I don't. I know in my mind, I know this like really powerful thing I want to say, and I just can never get it to kind of translate in that way. When you were talking about, so obviously writing your blog is really, there's an impact there. You were talking about kind of people's voices, and you touched a lot, or you mentioned social media. What do you think about social media? And when I mean social media, I mean in the veterinary profession. So you have a voice which is actually, unique. You have a great amount of experience that is not directly comparable to anyone else, and you have a voice, you have an opinion. What do you, how do you feel about kind of sharing your opinion on kind of veterinary social media channels? Is that something that you, is that important? Is that a powerful way of us sort of communicating in the profession? What's your, what are your feelings about social media?
Yes.
Not involving owners, not involving owners. I
Yeah,
mean like
okay.
our social media, you're the one that owners don't
Within the
see.
profession, yeah.
Yes, yeah.
So again, like most things, it's most definitely a double-edged sword there. First of all, I have to say I'm in quite a privileged position to be able to speak the words that I speak because I don't have an employer. I am my employer. So I don't have to be careful about what I say. Now, I certainly don't want to mouth off about any particular section of the profession or anything like that, that everything has a positive and a negative. But I do have to recognize that I'm in a privileged position that I can say these words without having to have the repercussions that some people would have. So that's the first point. As for social media, so it most definitely has a much bigger reach than just a blog. But saying that, I've had plenty of people message me, email me from my blog thanking me for writing about these difficult topics. So it definitely does get out there. But social media is more an immediate impact and gets through to more people. Problem is, it's an echo chamber for either really, really positive or most of the time really, really negative. So if somebody takes a dislike to something and starts putting some negative comments on something, remarks, then it just seems to overwhelmingly all become negative. So, yes, I will use social media to a certain degree, but I think it's also something you have to be quite cautious about. It can be quite difficult as an individual to deal with that.
But what do you think about the opposite to that though? Because I think, the other side of that is just that overwhelming positivity. And then maybe not, is there a danger there too, where we're just like, oh, it's all fine. Lovely. Well, obviously we want to be kind to people. That's a no-brainer. But what I mean is, can we then, and you kind of touched on this before, can we then shy away from actually facing some of these difficult problems because we just want it? And I'm maybe more like that. I just want everything to be fine and everything to go away. That's, I would be like,
Well, don't
oh,
we all wish that? I mean,
yes.
why would we want to have difficulties in our lives?
Sure. Yeah.
So
Yeah. No.
that's totally normal.
Yeah. But then I think, does that run the risk of then not facing the fact that we need to have these challenging conversations, like you say, and maybe that's important too.
Yes, most definitely is important to have these difficult conversations. It's just on social media because, well, keyboard warriors, most people don't even have their real name on it, or they have a little, what's the little picture called? The thumbnail. It's not even a picture of themselves. So there's that disconnect. It's not like you and I talking to each other. We can see each other's faces and our reactions. And it's most definitely not like having a discussion with somebody in the same room as you, that we very difficult to have those nuanced conversations on social media because it's just difficult to type enough. And the subtleties of the body language and the things that go along with the communication are lost. So if you are trying to be witty, you don't get that. If you so yeah, it's very difficult to just get it right on social media.
Yeah, I agree. That's right. The yes, half of the problems, if not more, would not be problems if we were having a conversation in person. Absolutely. One of the things that in conversations we've had previously that I thought was really interesting is the fact that you've carved out your clinical career in the way that you want it to be, which I respect massively. But one of the things that I think that is really interesting about your role, sort of doing work where you travel around different clinics, you know, offering kind of medicine, ultrasound support. You also take on a non-clinical supporting role in much of the work that you do.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting. So just for the listeners, you know, you, to simplify what you do, which I don't want to do any injustice, but you are a vet that travels to a number of different clinics and offers medicine and ultrasound support to vets in primary care practice. Did I get that right? Is that very simplified?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
But one of the interesting things, as I said, was that you find yourself offering non-clinical support as well. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, certainly. So, on the face of what I do, I'm a roving vet providing those medicine and ultrasounds and cardiology services. But it's turned out to be much more than just a clinical service. So, yes, I'm doing those medicine cases and those ultrasound cases that I'm called to do. But when I'm there, the vets often ask me about other cases. I am teaching them ultrasound while I'm doing the ultrasound, helping them understand a bit deeper in medicine cases about how to various treatments and further investigations, etc. But it naturally falls into more of a wider non-clinical role as well, is that in some of the practices I go to, I am the most experienced and oldest vet that they see. the conversation quite often turns to recruitment, how do I ask for a pay rise, mm-hmm. difficulties in their job at the moment. Because we're sitting in a dark, quiet room, and I guess I'm a good ear, and I'm an experienced vet that writes about these things in a profession. And yeah, I see my role as much more holistic than just that medicine and ultrasound service.
And I think that's really nice. And I think, you know, what we're probably lacking in the profession sometimes is vets that do have your age. Why is this always about age? You're not old.
No. I've still got another like 20-25 years of clinical work.
Yeah. So. But I think but we're often losing vets, I think, of your kind of, you know, experience where you are. So, you know, I think you're in a surprisingly unique position where, you know, 20-30 years ago, it wouldn't be unusual for vets to be in their 40s, still doing the job, you know, obviously gathering other qualifications and things. But I think that does become more unique where people squiggle a little bit more. But I think coming back to kind of where we started, you know, although you are very much still seeing patients, you know, doing clinical work, it's okay to squiggle, would you say?
Oh, definitely. I mean, how boring would it be to actually do the same job every day?
Right.
Kind of looking back, it's like, why did I think I would just go straight into one job and stay there for the whole of my working life? How boring would that be?
Right. But there's the soundbite. That's the clip. Like, that's the moment you're like, well, actually, no, that would be really rubbish. Why do we even want to do that? We shouldn't even want to start out doing that in the first place.
Yeah, I'm curious. I want to go and see what other things I can do, and where is this wonderful career going to teach me? And I know one of the questions you usually ask your interviewees is what you want to be when you grow up. So I don't want to grow up. I want to be curious and investigate and be inspired by this profession forever.
But I genuinely think that that's the, you know, I don't. We've talked a lot on the podcast about people squiggling. I don't think anyone's ever said, well, why would I not want to do that? Because actually that would be boring just to do, you know, and I really like the way you framed that, because I think actually that's the reality of that situation. And that should be liberating. And that should be the way that we're thinking about things. You know, at the end of the day, why would you want to do that? You know what I mean? And I think that's very, very powerful to be able to kind of put that out there, you know, if nothing else, you know, for me, that just, you know, that just makes a huge amount of sense.
Well, we also have to realize that we as individuals, we don't stay the same through our lives. We change, our wants and needs change. We want to do different things. Culture is changing. Mm-hmm. Like, clients want different things now than they did when I graduated 20 plus years ago. So things change, and therefore to change, we can't just stay still.
Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, the world is so different. You're absolutely right. You know, and if we have this conversation again in 10 years, it would be a different conversation completely.
I'm sure.
Do you know what I mean? For sure. So talking about some of the questions that we like to ask people. So we've determined that you don't want to grow up. So that's good. Let's talk about, you know, the fact that you will be, you know, inspiring people through the clinical work you do and also some of the non-clinical work you do, particularly, you know, your writing and things. Can you talk a little bit about who might inspire you?
So I'm inspired a little bit by everybody that I meet and speak to or read about. That I can't think that there's one standout person. There's maybe a few female travel writers from 100-150 years ago that inspire me in my travels. But as in the kind of veterinary profession, I think everybody inspires me in some little way. And even if that's been a negative impact on me, I'm still inspired to change or do something different from that. So yeah, everybody inspires me.
No one's ever said female travel writers from 150 years ago. That sounds very cool. Can you name one of them? Like, I'm just interested who they might be. Like, can I just randomly, I can't remember what we were watching. It was something to do with, like, you know, travel to like the poles, Arctic, Antarctic. And there was this woman that did that amongst all these men, and it was very inspiring, but I'm not telling the story very well. Anyway, maybe you can help us.
So yeah, I've been to the Arctic and the Antarctic. I'm a great traveler. I think travel can teach us a lot about ourselves and also help us to put our own experiences into the context of how other people have to live their lives as well. So I think travel is really important for all of us to expand our minds. As to a particular female writer, I think probably the one that's jumping to mind is someone called Freya Stark.
Right. Tell us about Freya.
So she was writing in the 1920s, 30s, into the 40s as well. And she was a Middle Eastern traveler. She traveled in the Middle East at a time when it was rare to have outsiders, white people there, as a single female.
Wow.
And she wrote about experiences.
Isn't that cool? And yeah, I think that's so interesting. And to have, you know, again, God, I wish I was like better at reading stuff. I'm so rubbish. I should read more things. That's my inspiration from today. That's very, very cool. And really cool, actually, that really interesting, you know, thoughts about traveling. And I couldn't agree more. I just think that, do you know, the other thing that it just makes me realize is that we're actually very small, you know, and that's not a bad thing. Like, really, when you think
we're all connected.
Yeah, but understanding that there's, you know, when we sit there and worry that, you know, everyone's thinking negatively, well, this is, again, just everyone thinking badly of you if you've done this thing. And actually, you know, you're this tiny little dot, you know, and actually in the best way, you know what I mean? But that perspective, that perspective is really important.
We live too much in our own heads.
Yeah, yeah.
When you travel, you suddenly realize, actually, no, these people don't care about you.
No, absolutely not. And you know, and that, again, not God, we're getting really political, but you know, when I watch, for instance, the American politics, unfolding, and I just think to myself, God, you know, you all think you're the center, the universe revolves around you and what you're doing. We actually don't really care. We don't really care. Just it's. I'd rather turn this off and not listen. Anyway, great. What a good answer. So, you know, always interested to hear the answer to this. But if you were to kind of go back now and, you know, that moment where you make that application to vet school, do you think you would? Would you do it again? Would you apply to vet school? Would you go through that? And, you know, or would you decide on a different career if you had your time again?
Definitely 100% choose vet school again. Definitely. it's a passport to a great career as a clinical vet, but also so many other options as well, which I've kind of really only become more aware about in the past 5-6 years. But it is a great profession. Yes, we have our problems, but if you speak to people working elsewhere, they have their problems in other professions and other lines of work as well.
Totally.
I wouldn't want to be on a roof fixing our roof. It's leaking. We're having to get it replaced. I wouldn't want to be a roofer. They've got their own problems.
I love that. Roofers have got their own problems. Hashtag let's do that. But it's true, you know, there isn't a perfect job. Where did you go to vet school again? Remind me, Glasgow, was it Glasgow or Edinburgh?
The best one, Glasgow.
Oh, I always imagine that you're an Edinburgh graduate. I'm deeply disappointed when you're
Oh, I'm so sorry for you. Well, I can make you feel better. My little sister did go to Edinburgh. She went to the dig.
Did she? Yeah. Okay. That's balanced, isn't it? That's balanced out. Yeah. I felt like I was going up in the world because I'm from Glasgow, but I felt like I really made it when I got to Edinburgh, you know?
But Glasgow vet school's out in Mill Guy. It's like in the posh bit of Glasgow.
True, that's true. And actually, yes, that's true, actually. And it's funny because Karen, who edits the podcast, she always had a big house. It was out in Bears Den. Do you know what I mean? So it was that was the good place to live. We felt like we were going up in the world when we went to visit her house. Anyway, lovely. So, I don't know why I felt completely thrown off track there. I've completely forgotten what the... Oh. I'm sure there's another question that I normally ask.
Advice. What advice?
You should take over.
No, I had a little reminder what you were going to ask me.
Thank God you do. So based on your wealth of experience, what piece of advice would you give to those listening, do you think?
So I would advise people to invest in themselves. No one is going to invest in you more than you invest in yourself. And that's whether that's self-development. I really urge people to become as self-aware as they possibly can. It's not an option, I don't think. But also new skills and knowledge, but also doing stuff they find enjoyable as well. Quite a lot of that is not veterinary for me. I do lots of crafting and volunteering as well. Investing in those things in your life will make your life much richer. You'll understand where you're coming from, what you need to do to make your life the way it needs to be. And we always say, think about, well, it'll make me happy. Well, happy is one of those ephemeral things like beauty. It's there for a fleeting moment, but you want to be contented in your life and understanding what it is that makes you tick, and therefore to find or create a job or a role or in a life around those things is so important. So yeah, I'm sure you've heard of Simon Sinek and his finding your why. I urge everybody, find your why. It might take quite a few years. It took me until just a couple of years ago, but it really is eye-opening when you do.
Gosh, that's really great. Thank you. Thanks for sharing what you have today. I think you've got a really interesting perspective on things, and I'm sure people will find this conversation really inspiring and very helpful. So thank you for taking the time to chat to us today.
Well, thank you as well.
So a massive thank you to Sarah for chatting today. And as I said, I really hope that some of the topics that we've covered today are helpful to those that are listening. Quickly, if you will allow me to say that I am very sorry to hear of the redundancies that are affecting our profession again, particularly within the United Kingdom. And although I can't do anything necessarily to directly make that better, I can remind all of you, particularly those of you who are facing the stress of redundancy, that you are incredibly valued individuals. And we see you, and I am so sorry that you're going through what you're going through. And I genuinely want you to remember why you got into this profession, and remember how important and talented and brilliant you are as an individual. And I wanted to share some words of my favourite poet, Donna Ashworth, And these are definitely words that really help me at times that I feel maybe things are not going so well. So the poem is called You. If every single person who has liked you in your lifetime were to light up on a map, it would create the most glitteringly beautiful network you could imagine. Throw in the strangers you've been kind to, the people you've made laugh or inspired along the way, and that star-bright web of you would be an impressive sight to behold. You're so much more than you think you are. You've done so much more than you realise. You're trailing a bright pathway that you don't even know about. What a thing indeed. A massive thank you to Sarah for chatting today, and I really do hope that some of what we discussed is helpful to those of you, particularly those of you that are facing some of the key challenges that we have in our profession at the moment. We're going to move on to our clinical segment now, where we're chatting to the wonderful Sophie about AI in veterinary medicine with a dermatology focus, and to say again that this podcast is kindly sponsored by Zoetis and is intended for members of the veterinary profession. And so by continuing to listen, you confirm that that describes you. Right. Well, Sophie, it's such a joy to have you join us here again today. I think we have to pay really special tribute to the fact that actually this is your second appearance on our podcast. And actually, that's a short list. I'm trying to think. I think it's maybe just, oh no, Katie Ford and Rosie Alistair. I mean, what a lineup. So you're actually...
Oh, wow. I'm following in the footsteps of giants here. No pressure.
But that's, isn't it, that you are, you're only, I think, the third person to be on more than once. So that's a pretty special thing. So there you go. So really nice to have you again today. I think it's been a while since we've spoken to you. So I just wonder if you could just quickly recap on just who you are, a little bit about what you do in our wonderful profession.
Okay, thank you. So I'm Sophie Jacquet, and my official title is Diagnostics National Veterinary Manager for Zoetis UK. So what I do is I look after anything medically related to our diagnostics portfolio. So we have a wide array of different diagnostic analyzers that we typically use in our practice laboratory. And I support both our veterinary professionals who use our equipment, get the most out of their equipment, and also any medical questions that they may have about a diagnostic test or assay. Mm-hmm. And then also I support colleagues in the company that I work with. And that might be in terms of training and development, and also just expanding their knowledge about specific disease areas and how we go about diagnosing different diseases. So that literally is it within a nutshell. There's a lot more to the role itself, but that's just a top line intro, really.
I think it's interesting because when we last spoke, which was a number of years ago now, I think that we would never, this is a new role, well, a different role from the one I think you were doing before. So really interesting to kind of, to see how companies develop in different spaces and actually how they can expand what they're offering. I love, again, I joke every time when I speak to people from your team that I love the word portfolio. You all use it. It's a really, I shouldn't joke, but it's funny because it sounds really, I don't know, it sounds like you're all like fashion designers from Paris.
Yeah, my portfolio of work, my designs. Yeah.
I love that term. Anyway,
I think no matter what your line of work is in the veterinary profession, I think development is important to give you your job satisfaction and your drive and motivation as well. So I think it's really important, and having an idea of where it is you want to go, what's your next step as well as part of it.
And I think it's interesting because I think people will maybe think of Zoetis as a certain sort of thing, you know, where they're making drugs or whatever, you know. And I think it's always fascinating to watch, you know, how companies develop and the different things that they're offering. So what we're going to actually focus on talking about today is really interesting. And we're actually talking about AI or artificial intelligence. And this is such a, and really we're talking about the use of AI in veterinary medicine, the responsible use of AI in veterinary medicine.
Yeah.
But it's really something, you know, again, something that I, and I'm sure many of the listeners will personally have been maybe not that aware of a year ago and really aware of now. And and it really does creep into every element of our lives now. When, you know, even when you, you know, look something up on the internet, there's AI at work, you know, giving you an answer to your question now that I'm much more aware of than I was before. And obviously, without naming any names, there are very popular AI platforms that a lot of people are using to do lots of things, you know. Yeah. And I, you know, you can literally type in almost anything and get the answer to almost any question. So it's really it's really crazy. So I don't know if you can talk just a little bit about what I suppose AI is in the context of our veterinary sphere. How does that creep into our lives now, do you think, in a positive way?
Yeah, so absolutely right. I think when it comes to AI and artificial intelligence, I think for me, when I first started learning about AI, I think my preconceptions of it was that it came across as a bit cold, a bit robotic, a bit too futuristic for me. But as I started to learn a bit more about AI, I've realized actually it does come with its benefits, its advantages, if we harness it in the right way as well. And as you said, we all have probably had interactions with AI, either professionally or more likely personally. So if you think about things like using a chatbot to, if I bought something online, I have to return it. Often you have to engage with a chatbot to initiate that process of a return. And you've got, as you said, quite rightly, things like generative AI, where artificial intelligence will generate text or images or write code, which makes me sound really clever. We all will have had interactions with AI, and it is an area of veterinary medicine that's really in development, and it's developing at a pace. So if we think about AI, we may already use it already in practice, so radiology being a big one in the veterinary arena. And it's also making advances within the human health arena as well. So if you think about things like screening, it's used extensively in breast cancer screening, etc. So it's definitely an area that's ripe for further development. And where we come in as a diagnostics company is looking at image recognition technology, particularly when we think about the microscopic digital diagnostics. So that's where we are really focusing our attentions currently. So there's different types of AI that can be used for image recognition technology. So we typically refer to them as either superficial machine learning or deep learning. And we worked with technology to develop deep learning AI algorithms. So the way I can best describe it in a very simplistic form is when we think about training a computer algorithm, there's different ways that we can do that. So with superficial machine learning, we tend to have human experts that label objects of interest. So for example, a human expert will pick out the features that make a cell, for example. So if you think about a neutrophil, we'll have a human expert that will label the features of interest, the characteristics that make a neutrophil a neutrophil. So it might be that that human expert will label the size of the cell, the shape of the cell or the nucleus, or look at the nuclear cytoplasm ratio, just things like that. But it all needs a human eye to identify those features and label them. Whereas with deep learning, what the algorithm does is it looks for these features itself, and it will look for features that a human eye may not necessarily be able to detect. And then it will assemble all of these features to identify an object, classify that neutrophil as being a neutrophil. And where the human expertise comes in, because there's still human expertise required, a human looks at the algorithm's deduction and ensures that it's making the correct classification. And then from there, we can make some tweaks to the algorithm to refine it. But what we need is lots of data. In order to train a computer algorithm to perform image recognition technology, we need lots and lots of images of those cells or those parasite eggs or whatever it is we're interested in identifying microscopically. We need a lot of data to train that algorithm. So that's kind of my simplistic explanation of it. But what's important with AI when we're using in veterinary medicine is that we continuously monitor its performance. We don't just let it loose. We have to constantly monitor that AI's performance to ensure it's performing with accuracy.
Crazy, really, isn't it? I think it's so interesting. And what, so without, you know, just to kind of drill down to what you're actually talking about here, you're talking about, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of digital cytology type offerings where, you know, we're actually able to use AI to look under the microscope. Is that in essence what you're, one of the things that you're kind of talking about?
Yeah, exactly that. So we, you know, if you've put a sample onto a glass slide and you're going to look at it yourself under a microscope, essentially what we can do is train AI with the data I've mentioned, you know, bundles and bundles of data, to actually train a computer algorithm to look at that sample for you and identify what's on that slide. So it will be able to, it's impressive.
I love that. It's, you know, it is impressive. And I think that, you know, the thing is, like, I think my initial, it's really fascinating, genuinely, talking about this, because when you started and you mentioned radiography, I my gut reaction was like, oh, that feels a bit like, you know, that's like something that we do as veterinary professionals. You know, it's that kind of feeling of like, oh, we're being replaced, right? And I know that's kind of really like, that's not accurate. But as you kind of talk about this more, I think particularly in the digital cytology platform where you can literally, you know, put a mic, you know, get a microscope slide read by technology or someone remotely or whatever, but I mean, we're talking here about technology where you're getting an accurate assessment quickly. And I think that's one of the key things, because what I then imagine when we're talking about this is, you know, it's 4 o'clock in the morning and, you know, and actually looking under the microscope can be stressful. People don't know always what they're looking at. So actually cytology can sometimes be really stressful, right? Because people are like, oh, I don't do this enough. I really need to get this read by, you know, a cytopathologist. Like, this is stressful. And so actually, if there's ways that we can help support people with that kind of information, then that must be a good thing, right?
Yeah, I believe there's definitely a place for it. And absolutely, to speak to the point that you made with regards to the concern around AI replacing, you know, it's taking a job away from me. Absolutely not. It's there to support you, I guess, in the sense that you may not have the time to look at the sample as thoroughly as you would like, or you may not be sure what you're looking at, exactly what you said. So just having that layer of support to say, I'm not sure, let me have AI take a look at this and give me its read. But we also recognize that there's absolutely a need for humans with this. It's not an either or situation. It's bringing the expertise together. So when we train the AI to look at that microscope slide, whatever it is, whatever the sample is on that slide, essentially we train it to the level of an expert in that field. So depending on the sample, if it's cytology, we'll have board certified clinical pathologists involved with the validation of that algorithm. But not only that, what we do is we will always support the AI read with the option of having a clinical pathologist look at the sample as well. So again, it's just layering in that human expertise as well and giving you a quick turnaround in terms of the read, the report that the clinical pathologist issues typically is within a couple of hours of you submitting the sample. So again, it's about making it more accessible, expediting that report back to you so that you can make timely medical decisions as well.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I think that really is amazing, you know, and I think that, so if you were getting an AI read on some cytology, how quickly would that come back to you?
So when, if we're talking about, so with AI, we've got different applications. So it can read, when we think about dogs and cats, it can read like so fecal samples. It can read dermatology, cytology samples or blood smears, for example. So with getting the AI to do that, typically, depending on your connectivity in the practice, essentially you'd get that within 10, 15 minutes.
Oh my
so you
God.
prepare your sample as you would ordinarily, and then select AI to read it for you. And again, if this is a complex case or you just want a second opinion, then again, you can just click a button to add on an expert review and a clinical pathologist will take a look at it for you and then will
Wow.
give you the report back within a couple of hours. But I think for me, the other really cool piece of the AI read is that, as well as the ClinPath read, is that you will get images selected. So you won't just get a written report. You'll also have a report that has images within it so that you can actually, you know, verify yourself what that AI is reading, identifying what the ClinPath is looking at.
Yeah.
And, you know, learn, I guess, from it as well.
So cool. Yeah. And do you, what kind of special kit do you need in practice to be able to, because I feel like I want this now. What do you do? What do you need? Do you need like a, I feel like, do you need R2-D2 in your practice or what?
Yeah, C-3PO.
Yes, yes, you do.
Yeah. So yeah, so any Star Wars, you know, character would be fine. No, so essentially, we have a little scanning device. It's called a VetScan Imagist, and essentially, it consists of a scanner. So it's a little ditty, like microscope almost, where you load your samples onto the platform, but really, everything happens within the cloud. So that's where the algorithms sit. They sit there. So it is a little bit Star Wars like. So
it's just around. I just, isn't it crazy? I mean, it's so cool. Like, it's just the cloud. I mean, who really knows what that is? But sure, yeah. It's just around us.
It's dispersed in the cloud and then magic happens. Essentially, that's where, yeah, the magic happens, I guess. So I think it's impressive that you can essentially take the sample, use image recognition technology that sat within the cloud to look at the sample and then give you that report within a matter of minutes.
That's very cool, isn't it? If only we were the ones that had come up with this technology, I think we might be on recording this on a desert island somewhere. So I think... We should have come up with that idea. You know that I love that when you hear about things and you're like, God, if only I was smart enough to like think of this.
I know. it is crazy though, because there's so many people involved in terms of the technology and training it and then monitoring it, etc. It's, yeah, it takes more than one person.
And it must be, it must be quite cool to be involved in this sort of stuff that's quite cutting edge. It is interesting. Like, I'm sitting here thinking, God, this is fascinating. Do you know what I mean? So this, it's an interesting sort of area to be focused on. I think our focus on our chats with you and your lovely colleagues is dermatology. And so just coming back really to the dermatology focus, as far as just, I suppose, expand a little bit more about how this sort of technology is particularly valuable for dermatology.
Yeah, so the platform VetScan Imagist It year on year has had new AI applications added to it. So in 2023, so last year, we launched an AI application, which was AI dermatology. So the platform can essentially read ear swabs, skin swabs, impression smears, and identify whether the sample has got bacteria, so rod, cocci bacteria, yeast, Malassezia, for example, and also inflammatory cells as well. So we recognize that cytology is such a critical, important part of the dermatology workup. So we thought, well, actually having AI that's able to look at cytology samples quickly, accurately, and actually provide you a report that identifies what's on that sample that you've submitted actually would be really useful in the field of dermatology. And we all know the challenges that we face when it comes to derm in practice. You know, we may be faced with not enough resource, not enough time. Maybe the confidence challenges of what you're looking at, what you're seeing as well. So again, we thought actually having AI and its ability to read a sample for you would actually be very useful. So it really complemented our pharmaceutical side of the portfolio as well. So yes, we've got solutions in terms of treatments, but also making sure we're prescribing appropriately. And actually working these cases up fully, that's where technology could really be of use to myself on the front line. So
Really, really cool. Yeah, no, that's so, it's really interesting. And I just think, again, it, you know, one of the things is for me is just is always seeing these things as just benefits and never replacements for, you know, the work. Because I think, you know, regardless of all of this, I don't think we'd ever get to the stage where AI would be able to have interactions with our, you know, pet caregivers, as we do. You know, I think there's still the human part of veterinary medicine is still so important. And so, you know, I don't think we're ever going to get to the stage where, you know, I was about to say I still want to be able to reach out and touch my clients, but I'm not sure that like in a very appropriate way.
it.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like with all, you know, HR have been involved only once. No, I'm joking. You know, but like, you know, I do genuinely think that human, you know, interaction is really important. But what you've, you know, what you've talked about today is honestly fascinating. What do you know, being involved in this really exciting sort of sphere that you're in, what do you think that, where do you think we go next with this sort of stuff? Like, what do you, we, do you think we're just scraping the surface? Is there more to come?
Yeah, I think there's definitely room for further development here. And before I answer that question, I'll go back to the original point you made there, because I do think it's really important. I think that when it comes to using AI, you still need the expertise, the clinical expertise, and the judgment of the vet or the veterinary professional. So the AI's, whilst it will tell you what it can see and identify what it can see on that slide, it's not going to then apply it to the case for you. You're still going to have to use your medical expertise to determine, okay, what is that differential list then, given what it's read, you know? And you may need to add on that the expert review, get a human to look at it, because you think, actually, maybe this doesn't match what I'm seeing, you know? So I think that interpretation and application to the case, no matter what piece of equipment you're using in your laboratory, you still need to use your clinical acumen and your expertise to knit it all together. So that's really, really important. So I would
Important.
say it's trying just to make it a bit easier for you and simplify your workflow and take the pressure off a little bit as well where possible. But yeah, I think with regards to where it goes next, I think that there's lots of different applications. So if you think about different applications in terms of sample types, so we're just scratching the surface. So as I said, year on year, we've brought out new applications to look at fecal samples, to look at skin samples, to look at urine samples. So there's definitely more sample types that could be expanded upon. There's just so many different avenues to be explored. But as I've said, it's never going to replace the human involvement there. And that's always going to be a key feature when it comes to launching new AI applications, that there will always be that human expertise underlying it to make sure that we've got that backup.
Yeah, no, it's really, really interesting. Thank you so much for, I must admit, going into that conversation when I'm like, oh, you know, you're chatting to Sophie about AI, and I'm like, oh, is that really? And then actually, do you know, that's one of the most interesting chats I've had. Like, I really do think, you know, you don't, it's so fascinating and then so very cool. And just to get, like, really interesting to for us to kind of, you know, cross paths at different points in our career. And the things you're doing are so much cooler than what I'm doing now. You've surpassed me in coolness.
Oh, you're too kind. You're too generous.
So I'm just
you're the one
really
sitting
cool
in Canada talking to me with all of your flash gear, professional setup.
Not really. I mean, it's like I said, it's 5 o'clock in the morning where I am, so it's not, I'm not living the dream, let's be honest. But that was really interesting. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us today. I really, really appreciate it, and just really, really fascinating stuff. So I look forward to coming over to your stand at a vet show sometime soon and meeting R2D2 in person. So I'll look forward to that.
Yeah, we'll see what we can do, Scott. That's okay. That's setting me up for a fall there, but thank you.
Anyway, thanks again.
Thanks, Scott. Cheers.
A massive thank you to Sophie for that really interesting conversation today, and a massive thank you again to Sarah for chatting. I want to thank you all, as always, for listening. We really, really appreciate your support. And if there's anyone that you'd like to hear on the podcast or any topics you'd like us to cover, then please do get in touch. To learn more about VTX and what we do, then please visit our website at www.vtx-cpd.com. And if you head over to the show notes of the podcast, you'll be able to find out information about all of our guests and a little bit about what they do. So that leaves me to thank you all again for listening, and I look forward to seeing you all next time.